Okay, I just want to talk a little bit before we go off for lunch at 12:30. So I want to come back to this idea of the Grail, because in a way that this process that we're looking at, the process, I think, of going into depth, of going into the inner stillness, of following the Song of the Tao, we could say, is also this thing that is written about as the search for the Grail, the search for nourishment, healing, resolution of opposites. You know, the poem Prithayanuvin is one of the earliest accounts of that search. You know, Arthur and his warriors descend into the other world, into the depths of Anuvin, into the, you know, Anuvin being this mysterious place, you know, the Welsh meaning of that word being the place that is not a place, or the place that is very deep. And in a way, this is the place that we encounter when we come into ourselves, when we become present, and instead of extroverting our senses, let ourselves move inwards, encountering the innerness of ourselves and the innerness of the world. Now, you know, the Arthurian story, the whole Arthurian, which is a massive, complicated story that has its roots really in pre-Christian Celtic Welsh tradition, principally. Spawned many, 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 many books and films and continuing treatments. And we have to get interested in some ways. Why does this story continue in our culture? You know, we're sort of, Fern and I were talking yesterday about indigenous spiritual traditions. And the one of the great problems that often is the case for Western people is the idea or the feeling sometimes that there are no indigenous traditions. If you look at Native American tradition, if you go to India, if you go to Nepal, people have their own very immediate indigenous traditions. And of course, one of our complications and difficulties, perhaps, is that the spiritual traditions of Western Europe, and in particular Britain, are largely Christian, and many of us have a complicated relationship with Christianity because of the political, because the Christianity has been used as a political system as well as a spiritual system since at least the time of Constantine. But what you get in the Arthurian stories, really, is a story that brings together mystical aspects of Christianity with pre-Christian traditions. And it gives the story a particular vigor. So it never goes away. Arthur literally is the king who dies and returns, the once and future king, the once upon a time king, the king who comes back, who is not, you know, in the stanzas of the grave in Welsh tradition, where there's a big list of all the graves of all the great heroes of Welsh traditions. And you come to Arthur and they say, no grave for Arthur, because Arthur is not dead but sleeping, and Arthur will come again. And there's lots of versions of this legend, really. You find all over the country. You find the sleepers of Alder Lea Edge. You find him somewhere in the depths of Cadair Idris. You find him in Arthur's Stone in the Gower. You find him in Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh. So you find this figure who is Arthur, who is a sort of his name comes from the Welsh word for bear. Arth means bear. Same root as in the Mabinogion, Math Sapnathonoi, bear, the son of the one that is like a bear. So the word Arthur, name Arthur comes out of a very old tradition of the bear kings, who guard the living tree, who guard the tree of life, who guard life in a sense. The other associated story with Arthur that we find is the story of the Grail. The story of this kind of miraculous thing that heals and nourishes everything. Now, popularly, the popular accounts of the Grail is in the cup that Jesus used in the Last Supper. But when you actually read the actual Grail romances, the early texts, you find that the Grail is associated with things like cups. It's also associated with swords, spears, dishes of meat sometimes. But the Grail itself is never named. It's a mystery. As we looked last weekend at what I think is the best definition of the Grail, which is a negative definition, which is that which does not regenerate is not the Grail. So the Grail is something that is impossible to define, but is known, or rather you know when it's not there. So if there's not regeneration, the Grail is not present. That which does not regenerate is not the Grail. Now, what you find both in the story of Arthur itself and the Grail story, which is in a way the story within the story, I suppose, of Arthurian tradition, is things begin in disorder. So Arthur, in the beginning of the story of Arthur, there is no king. The true king has been lost, and there's this whole kind of pantomime story, really, about drawing the sword from the stone in order to find the true king. Similarly, at the beginning of the Grail story, the land is wasted. It's called the wasteland. There is no fertility, no life in the land. And so the beginning point of Arthur's story, the beginning point of the Grail story, is in this place where things are not going well. And in a sense, what's the point of that story here and now today for us? It's the point of the story is to help us consider our own wasteland, or the wasteland in which we live. The places where there is the absence of flow, where things feel withered and dry and dead. And in a way, in the Grail stories, in the Arthurian story, there is this at the beginning of this place of recognition of the dryness, the deadness, the withering of things. There is the articulation of what must surely feel like a foolish hope. So coming back to this image of hope and fiery hope we looked at last time. Because in that place, in the story of Arthur, the foolish hope is the establishment of a kingdom of justice and peace and stability and balance at a time when everything is in chaos and robber barons are ruling the world. Could never happen, could it? Right, it's extraordinary if you think about it. So there's something very speaking, right? It speaks both into our own heart and to the political situation of our times. You know, the everywhere you look, actually, there are, you know, if I think of that bit at the beginning of the Arthurian story, where actually what you have are because without the king, there is no center. Without the king, the center point, there is no law. There is no justice. There is just the law of the strong. Now we look around our world at the moment, and if we consider that right now President Assad is probably barrel bombing his own people again, with the assistance of the Russian Empire, and the collusion of much of the rest of the world. It's the same story. Right? You know, the story of Assad, the story of the fascist government of Hungary, the story of the rise of fascism in Europe, the story of neo-Nazis in Washington doing Sieg Heil, Heil Trump. It's the same story. So, in these terrible times, within and without, it is in some ways the weakest, most foolish thing to decide, okay, I know what we need at this point. We need a center, we need a true king, we need, I don't mean literally a true king, but we need that sense of center, we need that sense of justice, we need the world to bring about a world where these things do not happen. When the land itself is withered and deeper, because this is in the political civic order, the story of Arthur, but in the story of the Grail, the land, the earth itself is withered and withering. That's also happening. Literally happening. The world is withering. And there is an absence in the Grail stories that the wells run dry. There is an absence of water. That's literally happening. Means many things other than the literal. But that also is happening. So these stories retell themselves to help us in terrible times. Wherever those terrible times are, the stories speak to whatever level, really. So in the personal, when we're going through terrible times and our heart feels withered and our hearts, and there is no flow in our lives, the story talks to us there. When we look into our place as citizens in civic society, it talks to us there. When we look at ourselves as people living in an ecosystem and as ecological beings, it talks to us there. And what it says, the next thing it says is something that sounds ridiculous. You must find the Grail. You must draw the sword from the stone and establish the kingdom of truth and justice. And, you know, one of the, you know, very often the knight who finds the Grail or the king or the young Arthur himself, in a way, is often this foolish kind of figure. I don't know if you've ever watched the John Borman film Excalibur, which is one of the retellings of Arthur's story. John Borman was always famous for putting his family in his films, and Arthur. And one of his choices, the Arthur is in Excalibur, is a kind of controversial choice, because he's played as a real loon. He's a bit thick, he's a bit daft, he's a bit sort of in his, you know, and he's not a brilliant actor, actually. But he's a bit of a loon. And there's something about that sense of being a loon, being a lunatic, lunacy, being a fool. And the naivete of that, which is also related to innocence and this word called hope, fiery hope. Because it's surely not sensible, not rational, at these points to say, right, fine, we need the true king, we need the centre, a new centre, we need a new world, we need to find the grail that will nourish and heal everybody. And if we're going to really address this issue, then we have to go and do this. We have to quest for the grail. Because Vool and Tara begins at Arapag, yeah. So there's something about these places, really, where we address the situation. Looking at the situation, that means in some ways we're just looking at the situation, become intimate with it. Which involves becoming intimate with our sense of powerlessness, of course. It involves knowing our own despair, our own feebleness. The impossibility of imagining a way forward. And there's a choice in that moment, really. The choice in that moment is to split and to shut down, or to choose to be aware. Not because we think being aware is going to make anything better, but just because in some ways it feels, you know, the folly, it's almost the folly of being aware. To choose to stay with our actual experience. Taking it on is a bit further down the line in some ways. So the first thing is just to be present with it. It's to, in some ways, it's before taking it on, you have to be present with the different levels of the experience, whether personal or political or ecological. You have to really, including, you know, our rage, our despair, our wish to shut down, our desire for it not to happen at all.
The first stone, isn't it?
The first step is just to choose to be with it, present with it. And then the next step, really, is in a way this formulation of the wish to find something that will help, find something that will progress, that will move, that will help ourselves or the world or something. And that's that act of intention, that's the desire, if you like, when you decide to become, to quest for the grail. Even though no one knows what the grail is. That's the great thing about this story, what I love about it, is that, I love all kinds of things about it, actually. One of the things I love is that people are always looking for grails. If you Google grail, it's great. The number of hits you get off the word grail, you get the holy grail of in business, holy grail of technology, you get, you know, it's an ubiquitous symbol in our culture. You know, it takes us, it represents something ineffable. So the holy grail of technology is of computer programming. In one place I was looking at was a spreadsheet system that could completely revolutionize your business. And it looked amazing. Becky and I have been looking at spreadsheets early in the week and looking at how the power of a spreadsheet, of bringing the mysterious into form. Really, you know, I'm not a great, none of you naturally, I'm definitely not naturally good at spreadsheets. And there's something about, suddenly there was a regeneration, mysterious regeneration arising out of the spreadsheet. In that moment, the grail was the spreadsheet. And in some ways, when we look at these stories, you know, we've got to get away from, in some ways, from the romantic images of them. We can have the romantic images as well, but they're not just romantic. That's the point. The grail is that which regenerates and is protean and appears in different forms in different places. The great thing that in the grail story, it gives you the food you most want and need at that moment. So that could be a spreadsheet. That could be somebody offering you a cup of tea at a particular moment. So the teacup becomes the grail, and the tea becomes the elixir of the grail that nourishes your body and your soul. Now what the story itself does, what the story of the grail does, is juxtapose two very potent opposites. It juxtaposes the idea of the withered place, the destroyed place, with the potency that can heal and restore things. So it's a big stretch. Yeah. It juxtaposes the withered, destroyed place with the mysterious thing that can restore everything. And as that, it puts us into, all opposites put us into tension. If we're not going to split and decide, I am for the withering. All this transformation stuff's a little shit. I am for the withering. Or, I am for the beauty and the glory of the grail and it's all illusion, that withering stuff. You're talking bollocks. Yeah. So we can do that, right? We can do that. Third choice, we just, I'm not into this at all. I'm just drinking myself. And sometimes the gin is also the grail. You know, but we'll come to that. But the other option is to be between the opposites. Now whenever you're between opposites, you're under tension, because you become the container. You become that which is holding, like it's holding two magnets, opposing poles of a magnet together. It takes effort, energy, and the place of the meeting of the different fields, which is where the potential, where the potency of the new life appears, is a tense, struggly place. So, of course, if you're going to look at two very major sets of opposites like this, the tension and the pressure that appears is enormous. You know, T.S. Eliot wrote this extraordinary, very powerful poem about the wasteland. Describes it very vividly, really, in the second verse of this poem. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, the dry stone no sound of water. Only, there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of the red rock, and I will show you something different from either. Your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. It's a very evocative image of the wasted, dried out place. And this powerful image, fear in a handful of dust. That is really very kind of strongly describing that. I'm going to read you another piece which is totally opposed to that. Find it. It's interesting, it's so difficult. And I understand why I'm finding it difficult. This is one of the most challenging, it's more challenging for me than The Wasteland, meaning this other quote. Obviously it passed through, but I can't see it. This is the writings of a woman called Julian of Norwich. Revelations of Divine Love, which in itself is a challenging thing, because it's the idea, what she, in her writings, this is a medieval woman who lived in Norwich and lived in a very turbulent, very powerful, awful time, a medieval political time. And what she's writing about is the presence of divine love, the tangible presence of divine love. So we have T.S. Eliot writing about the wasteland, the dryness, the absence of things. And in 32nd chapter of her book, what she tells us is, God said to me, all things shall be well. And another time he said, you shall see for yourself that all manner of things shall be well. And God wants us to know that he takes heed not only of noble and great things, but also of the little and the small, the humble and the simple, both the one and the other. And this is what he means when he says, all manner of things shall be well. For he wants us to know that the smallest thing will not be forgotten. I make all things well.
Do you know Effie Wilson?
Yeah.
She, I thought she illustrates the point by actually living in that way.
Yeah. Yes, she does. I mean, Etty Hilson was somebody who was died in a concentration camp, and really, I mean, she's really worth reading, actually, because she a very interesting woman, really, who kind of was able to put together the literal wasteland of the concentration camp, and the experience of the absence of the divine, together with a sense of presence and love. And in a way that's the challenge here somewhere. That's in a way the challenge of Julian of Norwich. You know, there's a very familiar quote if people know about Julian of Norwich. But to take that quote seriously, all manner of things will be well, will be made well. Not just the great, but the small, the particular. Now to hold that idea, intention with the wasteland in personal life, in political life, in environmental life. Now that starts to create tension if you attempt to hold those two potentials. I don't mean believe them. Belief, in a way, is not terribly useful. Belief collapses tension. Mm. It's to hold the possibility, to not dismiss that possibility. To hold the intention of and the intention is one of embodiment. To embody both the experience of the wasteland and the experience of all manner of things shall be well. All things will be made well. Nothing is forgotten. Now, what you'll normally find if you just try to do that is all kinds of reactions start to happen in you. You might reject the theological statement. You may hate the image of the wasteland. And that is the alchemical process. That's the beginning of the quest for the Grail. And that's what we're going to be looking at, really, in a way. Now, one of the traditional images of this beginning of the quest of the Grail is the knight comes away from the known places and finds themselves on the edge of a wood. Now, a wood in medieval times, when these things are written, is a dangerous place. There are wolves, there are bears, there are wild boars, there are certainly lots of robbers. It's a wild, tangled, pathless place. It isn't like Westonbirt Arboretum, beautiful though it is. I love it, but that isn't the kind of wood they're talking about. It is the wild, writer Charles Williams described the wood Brocéliande as a place where the saint and the sorcerer goes to do their work. So we're on the air, and the thing that the guidance that starts to happen in the woods, at the edge of the wood, normally what happens is the seeker gets the sight of a glimpse of a mysterious animal, normally a white stag, the white hart. And they just get a glimpse of this mysterious otherworldly fair figure. The White Hart, we're going to do some work with the image of the White Hart this weekend. It's a very, very ancient British image. You find it comes out of Celtic tradition, like a lot of the very early deep myths of the land. But you find in lots of pubs, for example, called the White Hart. Mm-hmm. And it's associated with kingship. Very often the White Hart has a crown around the neck, or they have golden antlers. Sometimes the hart has the figure as the crucified Christ between his antlers, because he's another kind of crucified king figure. But don't have to get into that too much at the moment. The thing about the white heart, the white heart is this thing that, again, it's protean, you glimpse it. It leads you onwards. You just get a glimpse of it and you follow it. And it takes you beyond yourself into the wild place, into the place where things are tangled and mysterious, and you have to make your own path somehow. Literally, the appearance of the white heart is whatever arises as you bring the opposite together. So that the thought of, whatever thought actually, the thought of, that's ridiculous, that all manner of things will be well. Really hate that idea. Easy for her. She was sat in a church in bloody Norwich all her life. She wasn't out there in the wars that were going on at that time. Right, so that's one of my reactions. So that, and that to me is, if you like, is that's the glimpse of the white heart, a glimpse of that which takes me beyond my known. Because when you put together opposites together like this, and if you can hold them, this is the tricky edge. If you hold them, and then a process kicks into being, which leads you beyond your known places. We're going to look at this all weekend, but I'm just going to finish today before we go for lunch, and just to read a very tangible example of somebody who's struggling with this. And this is my old teacher, Ernest Butler. And, this is from something he wrote in 1976. He probably wrote it before. That was published in 1976. It's got coffee stains on it because I was. When was I? 1976.
Nottingham.
I was in Nottingham. I was in Nottingham in 1976. Yes, drinking much gin and other things, and possibly, and then using coffee to try and drape us around. So I used to drink a lot of coffee in those days. This is just called an experience. When one describes a psychic, occult, or mystical experience, it is very necessary that the machinery of such experiences should be considered in order that the very real value of the experience may be gained. One of the difficulties we face when we try to do this is that the human nature of the percipient usually shows itself very plainly indeed in a determined attempt to put the highest valuation upon such personal experiences. Really, the person is not the best, always the best person to evaluate such exceptional happenings, unless they've been trained to use their mind in the correct way. Even then, they will lose much of the reality of the experience, because all such happenings have to pass through the channels of the mind and the psyche, and this psyche can and does distort whatever comes through it. So, recording this particular experience, which was mine some years ago, I must simply record the facts. And although I might be able to make some evaluation of the facts, I would prefer to put the straight facts of the experience before my readers, without any further comment. What value such an experience may have is very largely personal to the person who has it. One thing about such experiences is that if they are true contacts with the inner side of things, they will affect the personal outlook of those to whom they come. Did this experience affect me in any permanent way? Yes, I think I can say that it did. In one of the stories in the Old Testament of the Bible, it is recorded that its heroes suffered great calamities. So severe were they that his wife said to him, "Curse God and die." His reply was simple, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him." I think my own experience, whatever might be thought of it, has enabled me to affirm in a very real way, my absolute trust in the eternal love. In the somewhat chaotic and easily influenced part of my surface consciousness, I often have doubts, not only concerning such things, but even doubts of the whole of my life. I think we all tend to have such times of doubt, but at any rate, I know I do. Such mystical experiences as I've had were summed up and completed for me in this one. And as I said, now, under the wavering images of my mind, there resides an absolute conviction of the love of the eternal, I can say of him what was said by the Old Testament hero, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. Here then is the record of this experience. It came to me quite a few years ago, but is still as vivid in my mind as it was when it happened. Though, of course, much of the numinous feeling which accompanied it at the time has now become dim to me. Nonetheless, the results remain. I was very sad at heart, for a little friend of mine, with whom I had a special link of affection, had recently died. And although I knew of the survival of the soul beyond death, a knowledge based on many years of psychical experience, it seemed to me just then that such knowledge had no balm for my heart. Neither could the doctrine of karma reconcile me to the loss which we had all sustained. I was working then at an engineering works in Southampton, and on this particular day I was walking home for lunch when it happened. Between two successive steps along the pavement, I was caught up into the embrace of someone who seemed to be the very quintessence of love. I was out of time and stood in eternity. For in that eternal moment, time was not. All around me pulsed an atmosphere of brooding love, strong and tender, uplifting and supporting, showing in streams of living splendor and iridescence the faintly perceived outlines of a face. Eyes which seemed to draw one closer and still closer to the one who stood there, supporting me with power and comforting me by love. And the one for whom I had been sorrowing, she was there too, safe in the arms of that embodied love. A feeling of peace and happiness profound, and then all the sights and sounds of the mundane world came back. Only seconds later, I had walked two steps in time, but had been in eternity. I too, like many others, had met him in the way. I'll just leave that with you as we go into lunch. I mean, it's whatever it is. It's a man I loved and trusted. And what I like about it is I like two things about it. One, he talks about his conviction and his doubts. And then he just describes, this is what happened to me. As clearly and as barely as he can. And I like that. So, we'll leave it there.